Make sure I check the signal, and we'll check Dr. John Aldis's microphone, too, since he's right here. Why don't you go check, check, check.
Check, check, check.
Well, you're looking perfect right there. Okay. And we're waiting for Zaki. I don't know. He's going to try to park and back, and he's going to find out that someone left a big truck there, and I don't know if that's going to cause him a problem or not. But anyway, the second doctor just walked in, and we're going to... get him on here. In the meantime, let me do a little. Today, we're going to be doing some maintenance on the station after this program is over, and it'll play most of the day, but we may have some occasional outages as I try to repair the problem on the sound driver in one of my computers. Okay, so, oh my God. Oh, Lord of mercy. Dr. McGill, you just graduated to the top ranks. I am here, okay.
I want to talk to you after the show about a discount on future podcasts.
Okay, you can get them from nothing, pal, with that kind of donation. That's just you can get them they're free with those kind of donations.
At least a 50%.
Oh no, yeah, man, no, that'll cover July. You know, you just part of July. We have a number of issues here. One of the things I need to do is I've been finding out all kinds of things as I've been doing lots of research about ways to automate the station and. So I'm actually, it happened to me on was it Tuesday or Wednesday? Tuesday. When was the vigil for Wayne Jones?
Tuesday.
So here I am on Tuesday morning, okay? And this used to happen to me when I was working in the software industry, where, you know, if you get into programming, right, uh-huh. It's like you fall into a certain kind of zone, right? That is you can't get out of it once you're in it. And man, I was finding these ways to automate all this stuff here, and you got to get in the bottom part there. There you go. Okay. So that's what happened anyway. Before I knew it, it was like, you know, already noon, and I said, oh, I can't, you know. So I apologize, Zaki. I felt morally, you know, depraved for the rest of the day, but. Because I think everybody should go up there and help out until there's an answer about who killed and why Wayne Jones was killed. I don't think that question should go unanswered, you know, for the rest of the century.
So, I agree.
Anyway, but good morning.
You know, Zaki. Good morning, John, and good morning, listeners. The vigil on Tuesday, the vigil for justice of Wayne Jones was well attended, as usual. We have a hardcore 12 dozen people that show up, and sometimes it gets up to 15 or more. But the NAACP has formed an actual committee for Wayne Jones. There's some couple people on there. Uh-huh. That's their primary issue.
They're just keeping track of what's happening,
There's one British gentleman who has been coming to the NAACP for several years now, and that's always...
That's not Dick, is it?
No, that's Ian.
Oh, okay. Right.
We have two Brits. Ian and Dick are both Brits, and... And so Ian has really taken it on, and he's met with the attorney to get some updates. He gave us an update of the case on Tuesday night at the NAACP monthly meeting. And Ian has decided that we're mixing our messages with the various signs that people are holding up. He wants one uniform message, and that's justice for Wayne Jones. So he took it upon himself to get the membership to... print three more banners so that all four.
I like that too.
All four corners will just say "Justice for Wayne Jones." Okay,
that's okay. I'm good with. I think that makes sense. You know, it's true. For passers-by, there's no time to digest more than one message anyway. unless you're at the stop sign, frankly, okay? And, you know, we've had a couple of, there were a couple of messages up there. I remember there was one that I couldn't ever understand. It was X plus Y plus Z plus A plus Z minus this.
We had a school teacher who created that.
I just wasn't sure what that one meant, you know. But
yes, we had a school teacher that created that. And I it took me months to finally, oh, that's what that means.
Anyway, but yeah, so I
think. So it was a logarithm.
That's right, yeah.
But, you know, Ian's point in meeting with the attorney felt that having the Black Lives Matter banner may alienate some of the white supporters in town who otherwise could sign. I wasn't convinced of that argument, but you know what? We're a democratic organization, and there were enough people that felt, well, you know, maybe that's possible. So I mean,
whatever people think is the broadest, serious message, right? Okay. I mean, you don't want to be so broad to the point where your message is now meaningless. Okay. But I mean, if there was justice for Wayne Jones, I mean, it would impact all questions. Okay. So, you know, there's so many issues around just getting justice for him that you probably don't need to have, in that case. I think it's a straightforward, I think it makes sense. I would be persuaded by that argument if people felt that that would help focus things, you know.
Now that I've had a chance to sit with it and the membership on Tuesday night voted for it, I'm okay. I'm really okay with it. And I also think we need to up the volume in terms of, you know, confronting the judge who's just sitting on
Judge Groh. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Business about, oh, don't mess with the judge or shit.
I think it's time.
We're past that, right?
Yeah, I think it's time for maybe an open letter to the judge in the newspaper.
Right.
A letter campaign to her at the courthouse. Let her know that this is not going to go away. And people know her name and know that she's the main reason this hasn't proceeded.
And her argument, if I remember reading it, although I read it, I believe, in the journal, so you never know whether that's accurate, but was that, it was late. It was late. I mean, I have to have rules in my court or something like that. It was one of those. It was a technocratic argument.
Right.
A procedural argument. And it didn't respond to any of the substance of what the appeals had, the court had ruled.
And which,
as far as I know,
every attorney that I've talked to, you know, I have a score of them in my family and their friends.
Yes, you do.
And some of them are judges. And I've been on vacation and described this. And to a person, they've all said, a judge always has discretion about things like that. And the fact that the responses came back 2 days late over a Christmas and New Year's holiday is just, they just can't imagine how she justified that.
Well, you know, you could send a letter to her asking her to justify it. She won't answer it, is my guess.
Right.
Probably. But then I think it's fair game on the radio to speculate. Well, she hasn't told us. Here's the four possible reasons as to why she has not doing it. You know, one, she's compromised and owned by people who were involved in the freaking murder. That's one possibility.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
She has some relationship going on there, you know, that she can't do it.
Or relationship with some people high up in law enforcement organizations within this state.
That's right.
So she
could be compromised to the point where she can't render a fair judgment because she's owned by somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
There's been a lot of pressure put on her.
Or the political pressure, you know, to continue to allow cops to murder unarmed black men. Mm-hmm. We need to keep that one up.
Yeah. Sure.
Mm. You know, that whatever that pressure, you know, might be, right? Which is, we know it's out there.
Well, you know,
it's running the country right now.
Well, you know, John, you know, we need to get to our friend.
Yes, he's only got a half hour left on his meter, you know, so we have to be careful about that.
Okay. You know, continuing that same discussion, there was a couple of Facebook shows about a guy with his mobile phone recording his interaction to a cop who comes up and asks him. It's a check of all the drivers going through, and he's being very polite, very courteous, and saying, "No, I won't get out of my car. Thank you very much."
Yeah, I saw that.
He goes on and on and on and on. It's all very powerful, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And someone writes in, "What if that person was black?"
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is the ultimate vision of white privilege.
Yeah, it is in a way, because he stands on his rights and is allowed to go.
That's right.
You know, but right.
Yeah, that's right. He asked for a supervisor. He said, "You know, I'm on my way to work. I'm a taxpaying American. I don't have time for this. You know, you're getting in the way of my freedoms. Bring your supervisor over here."
Yeah.
And so, according to the tape I saw, a supervisor does come over and he confronts him as well. Yeah. You know, you don't have any right to ask me, you know, any of these questions. You know, I'm on my way to work. I'm minding my own business.
Yeah,
I haven't broken any rules. I'm not under suspicion for anything. You know, I want you to just let me go. And he's polite, but he's firm.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? Yeah, right. Yeah,
he's very firm.
But I mean, you know, I mean, and any others, we've seen lots of circumstances. Oh, get out of the car, you know, all right, you know, you're under arrest. Okay, we're gonna take you down. You know, the whole thing, right?
And you know, I've had people that I know that are Facebook friends who wrote on there, the kid was just being a smart ass. You know, what's the big deal about showing your ID? You know, all he's asking for is he took that position.
So, look, well, you know, we have fear is going to probably govern more than reason here in the near future. So,
absolutely.
Whatever you're afraid of. Anyway, absolutely. Why don't we welcome Dr. Aldous?
Officially. And why don't we... why don't you give the little podcast introduction so we can
so we can just tape it.
We could just start from here.
All right. Okay, let me do that here. All right, this is the Are You Crazy show, normally broadcast on Wednesdays, broadcast today on Friday, the 16th of June, 2017. Where Dr. Zaki McGill and myself, John Case, were interviewing Dr. John Aldous, who was the subject of a major article in the New Yorker magazine recently on the opioid epidemic, focusing on West Virginia and on Martinsburg, West Virginia, in particular, for a good part of it. And we'll be podcasting this. You can hear it on enlightenradio.org.
Good morning, John. Good morning, John and John. Good morning, listeners. This is Zaki McGill, and this is the Are You Crazy show. I have our wonderful guest, a repeat guest, a frequent flyer on this show, Dr. John Aldous, MD, who is one of our local heroes in the crusade to do something about our heroin epidemic. We have a lot of people talking about doing something about the heroin epidemic. But Dr. John Aldous is actually in the trenches day to day, you know, trying to help folks in a system which I can't even say the system's broken, because the system was never constructed. You know, we have an area of the Eastern Panhandle that just never had a functioning, you know, addiction recovery system. So I want to welcome Dr. Aldous, and for you listeners who aren't familiar with him, I'm going to have him do my little paint a portrait of yourself, a thumbnail portrait, where you were born, where'd you grow up, and how'd you end up back here in the Eastern Panhandle, and how'd you get interested in addiction treatment, John?
Well, I was born in Frederick, but my first home, my first house was in Shepherdstown. We moved here in 1945, right after I got born, and then stayed here until 1952, when my family moved to Kansas, and pretty much was in Kansas all the way through medical school, pretty much. And then I got drafted, it was Vietnam years, and went overseas for about 40 years, 10 years in the Navy and 18 years in the Foreign Service, and it's been a real experience. Then I did some research up in Frederick for about 10 years, and then I came back here and noticed people were dying, people working on my property, gardeners, tree service people, and I'm a doctor. I won't treat them myself, but I find a place they can go. There was no place. And I said, this is not working. This is not right. And I come to the same conclusion now. There's no place that has effective treatment. I did have to learn a little bit about addiction management, treatment, because it wasn't my field. I'm tropical medicine, public health, family practice, whatever. And so the more I learned about it, the more I realized, hey, there really isn't anything here. The number 6-month waiting line for treating a person in addiction who wants treatment, and for the effective treatments. So I did what I could. The first thing I got really deep into.
John, I'm going to stop you there because you have such an illustrious career that I just want to tell our listeners that if you want to read more on John's biography and background. I actually did an article on John for the Good newspaper about a year or so ago. You can go online and look up the Good newspaper of Shepherdstown. It's called In the Den of a Demon, that sort of profiles John and his travels around the world and then ending up back here in the Eastern Panhandle, having, you know, people very close to him die from the heroin epidemic and not being able to help them and find himself going back and getting some training in order to be able to help hands-on. And I asked John to come in today because he was featured in a really amazing article, expose, in The New Yorker. What's the date of that, John?
2 weeks ago. So what is
okay.
that?
Okay.
I'll get it.
But anyway, it was a June edition of the New Yorker.
June 5th
edition of the New Yorker, and it's called the Attic Next Door.
Attics.
The Attics Next Door.
Okay. Yeah, the Attics Next Door. Yeah. June 5th, 2017.
It's become quite a celebrated article, especially here in the Eastern Panhandle, and I understand all over the state, politicians and others are reading about. The epidemic. I actually had an opportunity to meet the author, Margaret Talbert, at John's house when he and his wife, Fenny, had me over for dinner. And boy, that was quite an experience just sitting and talking with her. So, John, go ahead.
You say all over the state, but when you have a career like mine, so much overseas, Foreign Service, Navy, all these years, I'm getting calls from all over the world.
Is that right?
Oh, my goodness.
People
yeah.
who've known me before, worked with me before. They're casually reading this article, and up pops my name.
And then you pop out.
They
wow.
immediately write to me. And that's been cool.
That's very cool. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you never know where print goes.
Where'd you live in Kansas, anyway?
Fort Scott, Kansas. Southeast Kansas.
Southeast. Oh, yeah, okay, right. Yeah. You know, I didn't go that. I used to sell Fuller Brush in Olathe, Kansas.
Olathe, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was my summer job.
Fuller Brush.
and after bath beauty mist smooths your skin, doesn't it? Time to shake the can.
Well, you know, Kansas is in the news in West Virginia now because folks are saying to our legislature, don't be like Kansas in terms right. of the draconian tax right. cuts that they experimented with and have devastated their state. So.
That's right. It's hard.
But,
so the article, I met with Margaret Talbert a number of times, and she attended several of my lectures, my Narcan lectures, and also a couple other talks I gave, opiate epidemic awareness kind of stuff. And but then I was helping transport her around the Eastern Panhandle here to meet other people. Boy, she was meeting a lot of people. And this went on literally for months. And most of the people mentioned in the article, I didn't even know she'd met. She was way, way, way ahead of me in who she was interviewing. of course, I didn't write the article. I didn't have anything to say about the article. So when it came out, you always get nervous when a journalist is interviewing you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I was anxious, and it came out totally different from what I thought it would, and much, much, much better.
Wow.
It's outstanding. Okay.
Do you know how she became connected with the Eastern Panhandle? What drew her here to this area?
Well, we're one of the worst. It's close
statistics.
To Washington. She's from Washington. It's an hour and a half drive.
Okay.
She comes by train usually. And also, it's one of the worst places for the opioid epidemic in the country.
Okay.
Or the world.
I see.
Depending on how you want to do the numbers.
Okay.
And so this would be a good place to start. Maybe part of her question, she never asked this, an hour and a half drive out of our nation's capital. How could anything be this bad?
Mm. Well, you could be that bad right in the nation's capital. Come on. I mean, it's a...
No, the numbers aren't there.
Well, maybe not now, but...
No, the numbers aren't there.
That's true.
I'm sorry.
The absolute numbers aren't
cocaine,
there?
Cocaine and stuff. Yes, you're right. A few years ago, back in the
90s. Well, then wasn't the mayor doing cocaine for a while, too?
Yes, he was. I confronted the mayor one time on that.
Oh, did you?
Personally. Face to face. That was intimate.
What did he say?
Well, what I asked him was, he was running for re-election, and I said, would you agree to a urine screen, drug screen, to see if you're still using? This guy, I don't know if you know this, is tall and big.
Oh, I have met.
And he looks down and...
I don't know him, but I know who he is, yeah.
And so...
or was.
You are talking about Marion Barry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And his comment was, it would be a distraction for me trying to get my work done, which was quite clever. I thought that was a good answer. Mm-hmm. I told him, wow, okay, I'll go with it. But he also asked where I worked. It was at the U.S. State Department at the time.
Yeah.
And I had the feeling there would be someone coming after me. It didn't happen, of course. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting.
I actually heard him at a meeting once that I went to. This is way back. This was back when Clinton was running for president, actually, the second time or something. And he was in a... And, you know, he is a serious guy.
Yeah.
Very serious.
Yeah, I mean, I think he fell off the wagon with a couple of things, but he was a serious guy. And
he was a hero of the civil rights era.
Yeah, I mean...
He came with, a portfolio,
But I mean,
he and his wife.
Yeah,
Effie Barry.
I didn't.
Effie Barry.
That's right. That's right. Right.
She was an intellect in her own right,
and he was an impressive guy. I mean, I remember he was arguing with somebody who was defending Clinton's sister soldier speech. There was a point where Clinton decided to separate himself from Jesse Jackson. I guess that's what you'd have to call it, okay?
Or the most vocal in the black resistance movement.
But, I mean, effectively, it was, going after, Jackson in a way. Because Jackson was at the same meeting.
Okay.
Where Clinton did that, all right, But Barry, went after why, he had a very, he didn't speak for that long, but about why that was a bad thing, that Bill did, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but why that advice, that kind of advice, okay, is like pervasive in Washington, shut down anything that sounds militant, shut down this, shut down that, right? Later you saw it with fire Van Jones.
Yeah.
To fire him, okay? Yeah, the minute it comes up that, my God, I used to hang out with commies somewhere.
Lonnie Guinier. Remember the queen?
Yeah.
A brilliant author, law attorney, prosecutor.
Right.
And because she says, we need to look at this system of democracy where, it's only about majority rule and the minority constantly gets passed over and adjust that. And it was a, I'll never forget, we're getting off the subject here, except that I guess the point I want to, I'm seeing from this is we're talking about a mayor who had a very illustrious background and career, was a real hero to a lot of people, but succumbed to addiction. Mm-hmm. And that's the case here in the Eastern Panhandle. a lot of us walk around thinking, ah, they're just drug addicts. And, you know, John, you can attest to this. You know, I've had describing to people your Narcan classes and had educated professional people turn to me and say, well, why bother? Just let them die. Yeah. Because, you know, they lump all addicts in the same category as
incurable,
you know, unproductive, you know, not worthy of treatment and attention.
We've had folks on the program that have not directly said that, but indirectly, in a way, they said, you know, don't worry about that. Save the kids.
Yikes. Well, that's true. Yeah.
Okay. Get the kids out of there. Spend your money there. Okay. Rather than on, I mean, you know, people have interesting priorities, right? When they think about the problem and how, and that's the other question I want to ask.
When you shrink the pie to where, yeah, people who are really passionate about helping
right.
end up throwing some people under
off the
bus
yes.
off the boat in order to save others, yeah, you get to an argument like that as
right.
opposed to growing the pie to where everyone who's passionate and in there helping the kids, their parents, you know, the professionals, deliver services.
But you're now up against a state and a federal government leadership that is going to cut the pie again, not expand it at all. Okay? I mean, and so we have a political problem that affects not only this question, but you could probably list 50 others. And that is that this, I don't want to, this billionaire, I do not want to pay taxes anymore campaign, which has been going on ever since Reagan, okay?
Right.
That these guys, no taxes, to hell with Roosevelt, to hell with Johnson, to hell with the New Deal, to hell with all that. You know, we're going to go back to where the billionaires run everything. And so, well, we're there. I mean, and now the question is that, you know, and they've starved the beast.
Yeah.
I mean, they have.
Right.
I mean, there's no question that they want to kill Medicaid. That's right. Their top priority. And whatever health reform they come out with, I promise you, it will kill Medicaid if it comes out of the Republicans, because they hate it.
Yeah.
You know, why should I pay for your medical care?
Right.
You know, if you're too poor to pay for your survival of the fittest, whatever. You know, I mean, natural selection has already. I mean, that these guys, you know, feed themselves that argument endlessly. I was raised with people
this. Yeah,
I know them well.
Okay, you know, one of the arguments against that is how many of those millionaires are paying for their own medical care? Their insurance company pays for it.
I know.
The taxpayers pay through it through government assistance.
Right.
The company pays for it. No, those rich guys are not paying their own medical care bills.
True.
Forget it.
True.
I know. My brother-in-law, he's gone.
Nor any
now,
of the congressmen.
I mean, every time, you couldn't even have dinner with him, you know, because he sold insurance, okay? And so the enemy of everything was socialized medicine. And then he finally got cancer. Okay, and became, only way he got treatment at all was, you know, he was covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield, some experimental program that was going on in Arkansas, because that university was specialized in his particular kind of cancer. And he spent 14 years on billions of dollars of treatments and all kinds of experimental stuff, and he didn't even pay a penny for it.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, and I, you know, he tell me next time about your, you know,
right,
private insurance thing, you know. But anyway, but you know, butter won't melt in their mouth. I mean, it's like, what? That's related to my political position somehow. I mean, it's a, huh?
Yeah.
I'm just doing whatever serves me best. You know, kind of bit.
Well, some of us say in the field that addiction is the great equalizer. You know, it affects the poor and the wealthy.
But you know, you can
men and women.
But if you got
black,
money,
white,
you can get the treatment.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You can Betty White, right? You know, Jerry Garcia.
They can send them off somewhere. But I, you know, I think that the reason we're paying attention now is that it's finally really impacting the white community.
That's right.
You know, when it was a black problem, a Hispanic poor problem, you know. It wasn't in the news. But
I thought all lives mattered.
But now, yeah, right.
Ms. Talbot mentioned several times in the article that all the people were white in her article.
In her article.
This is amazing. It's just a casual comment she makes here, there, in the article. And that's the current epidemic. Is that why we're concerned? That's annoying.
But is that why we're not concerned too? I mean, my point is that the majority, at least in the legislatures, is not concerned.
That's right.
They might want to use it as an. I can tell the prison industry, they'll weigh in. Oh, well, let's build another few couple of. Why don't you spend whatever last few dollars you have on another prison?
That's right.
That's what they'll say.
Yeah, and do something where they keep coming back over and over again.
Yes, it's like, I mean, that's, you know, when the software industry got in crisis and they found out they could not sell copyrighted software for a profit to recover the, they went in this thing, hey, maybe we can lease it to them or we'll get they'll pay us per month forever. Mm-hmm. Okay, a renewable income stream is like the golden calf of business, right? Models, you know, someone's going to pay me forever.
You know, earlier in our discussion here, you were talking about some of the stereotypes of addicts, people who are in addiction, we prefer to say, and all very, very negative and appropriately so. Except I'm a very privileged person in all this, and so is any other doctor who treats these people. We see them before treatment, we see people who aren't being treated, and we see patients who are in treatment. There is a huge difference. These people come back a week later after you see them the first time. They are transformed. I've had trouble recognizing them in the waiting room. They're that different. They do amazing. It's amazing. These are good people. I hate to use the word, but let's say it anyway. Normal people. These are like your friends, your neighbors. They're acting and behaving in a responsible way. They're trying to get their lives back together while they're in treatment, okay? It works. The treatment works. Mm-hmm. So,
John, why don't you share with us from the article some of the things that you felt were most poignant, other than the parts about you, of course.
Okay, that was the
most. We'll quote all the parts about Dr. John now.
So, no, what impressed me was she got quotes, stories, anecdotes, impressions from a wide swath of everyone here who is in any way touched by the epidemic, which is basically everybody. She's mentioning many, many people with many, many approaches. One thing I did very much like, and Zaki and I have talked about this, so what's the solution? Well, she doesn't come to solutions in this article. She makes a point of, you know, it's as if she reached deep into the dark recesses of the soul of Martinsburg, dragged it out, shook it in front of the reader and saying, this is what you got. What are you going to do about it? That was the point of her article. She was not going to come up with the solutions, but she accidentally did in the very last part of the article. When a young girl is finally on treatment, her mother has already accepted the fact, hey, it's good if she stays on the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. This is pretty profound. These are not highly educated people who went to medical school and stuff. She came to that conclusion. She gives her truck key to her daughter to drive her brother to a movie. And she said, I'm giving you a lot of trust with this. Don't throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
She comes back with the key, gives the key to her mother.
That's
how it goes. That is what this.
And you know, John, when I was reading that part, I was holding my breath because
right.
I was prepared for it to go the other way.
That's right. That's
that
right.
That she didn't come home, you know,
right.
with the truck.
Very powerful. That's why I tell people when you read this, go to the very end. Because that's when it hits you really hard.
Yeah, I mean.
Now, the other point is, though, she doesn't talk about solutions. She doesn't talk about ways to solve this. But yes, she does. The only success stories, the only success stories were people on medication-assisted treatment. Mm-hmm. She over and over again mentions people who went to long-term rehab dead 3 months later after they're released.
Oh, boy.
You know, they have no tolerance to the drug anymore because they've been in rehab for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe they've been not using for 2 or 3 months after the discharge. They have no tolerance left. So they use the same dose they're using before and they die. Long-term rehab is not the solution. Rehab centers are not the solution. These places in Florida costing up to $30,000 a month.
Yeah, sure.
And the parents are paying for that because most insurance companies say, no, that's crazy. We're not going to do that. That isn't that isn't a way to go. You were talking about let's send everybody away to Betty Ford centers and stuff. Yeah, try that here in Martinsburg, okay? That's not the solution.
It's a millionaire solution.
It's a millionaire solution, but there, the other solutions are here waiting to be used. I'm sorry, but it's Suboxone, Methadone, and Vivitrol. That's it. Just like CDC, FDA, DEA, SAMHSA, everybody in the medical group says, this is what we should do. And nobody is saying anything different in the medical, in the wider medical communities. And I'm afraid people really aren't listening here.
John, I'm going to push back a little bit because I've used rehabs. Mm-hmm. I've used rehab centers. I've been medical director of dual diagnosis units. But my point is, rehab is essential for some people. Mm-hmm. Some people need to get out of their environment for a while to just curb the knee-jerk impulse of their addiction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you have rehab without very tight aftercare, yeah, then it's going nowhere.
That's right.
And you know, any you know, my rehab centers, I mean, the last several days that a person is there, you are hammering home the aftercare. You are making sure that you know who is picking them up, when is their first appointment that day or the next day, and how tight, how often they are going to be seen in aftercare. Because, yeah, you just can't release somebody from a rehab, a 30-day inpatient rehab, and expect that that's going to float indefinitely.
That's how it's being done routinely. And especially if you go to Florida and you expect them to rehab in Martinsburg.
Right, okay? Exactly.
It doesn't work.
So I'll say that a rehab worth their weight would be a rehab who, if they're in Florida, that would say, you know, we've tried to connect you with resources back in Martinsburg, but they aren't available. Where else do you have relatives mm-hmm. that you could go live with mm-hmm. that are closer to an outpatient treatment program that would benefit you, you know?
This subject of long-term rehab, it has been researched.
Okay.
The benefits of it have been looked at. The post 3 month success stories, 6 months, 1 year success stories. That's what I based my statement on. Mm-hmm. The data mm-hmm. doesn't support putting everybody in addiction, steep in addiction, into long-term rehab. Because like I say, it's usually frequently not done well because they don't have good long-term. If you can capture after the discharge.
Are you defining long-term rehab as?
28 days.
28 days, yeah. Okay. So you're saying that doesn't work?
No, I didn't quite say that. But statistically, it doesn't work as well as long-term medication-assisted treatment.
On an outpatient basis.
On an outpatient basis.
Yeah, I get that.
Now, if you can capture that person, give them the 30-day, 28 days. That's fine. They learn to talk the talk. They learn the disease. Mm-hmm. They may be resisting it the whole time, but they're hearing it. Sure. And they're sitting there. They got nothing else to do but listen.
Right.
Okay? Then you get them into treatment before they leave the facility, mm-hmm. and you make sure with long-term follow-up mm-hmm. that they're going to some place that they'll continue to get treatment. Don't send them back here and have them wait 6 months to get into a clinic, you know, I mean, stuff like that. Then that's very successful. Long-term rehab always provides a good benefit, but by itself, it is not a solution or the solution.
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. So, in fact, I would say that an outpatient, a follow-up outpatient treatment that does not include medication-assisted treatment and contact with someone in recovery every day.
That's right.
Is a setup for failure.
That's right.
I recently, you know, had a client, alcoholic, who wasn't going to meetings every day. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is a setup for disaster. You are going to fail. I've sat with people prior to discharge from inpatient treatment, and I've said, you need to do what in recovery they call a 90 and 90, 90 meetings in 90 days. And they say, I can't do that. And I'm like, then you don't get it.
That's right.
You're not afraid enough of your disease. You know, if you think you can go a day without connecting with someone who's going to reinforce the message of staying sober and how close you are to relapsing.
You know, there are treatment facilities, I won't mention any names, right in our area, wider area, which actively tell the patients not to go to NAAA 12-step meetings.
Wow.
Why?
Because they think it gets in the way of their own counseling services.
Hmm. It's competitive,
but,
you mean?
But really wonderful colleague, Dr. Raleigh Sullivan in Morgantown, I went out there for several training sessions. I remember him shaking his finger in my face and saying, John, the only people who actually ever get well, but this is a guy who thought everyone should be on Suboxone. He meant off Suboxone. He meant totally drug-free. Are those who are up to their necks in NA.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones who ever succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really strong about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're absolutely correct. You have to have another recovering addict you can go to, a group of recovering addicts you can go to.
Right.
And if you don't have that, and the triggers start hitting you, not much hope.
Yeah, you know, the 12-step programs, meetings get disparaged a lot. You know, you hear things, it's just a bunch of addicts there, you know, reinforcing each other's behavior. And like anything in life, you know, nothing is perfect. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're going to have meetings where there may be some really unhealthy people there. And what I tell my clients is, then if you don't feel like you're getting what you need in that meeting, look for another meeting.
That's right.
You know, keep searching around until you find meetings where there's a lot of health there, where there are people there who have years of sobriety, abstinence, and are doing well, and that the things they are saying in the meeting ring true.
Now, again, though, similar to the discussion I did on long-term rehab, the 12-step programs by themselves have miserable data.
Mm.
They do not do well.
Right.
It's 12
right.
steps
right.
in addition to medication-assisted treatment. How do I say this? 12 steps are necessary but not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Necessary but not sufficient. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Sufficient means, and by the way, medication-assisted treatment by itself, the medicine by itself, is necessary but not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving somebody some strips of Suboxone and sending them out the door,
mm-hmm.
That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the other drugs. Okay? You have to have the psychosocial counseling, and I believe very strongly that the 12-step approach or this wonderful program Celebrate Recovery, there are a number of other groups around where you are closely tied to other people in various levels of recovery.
Exactly.
But the medication for a long time is still going to be necessary. Now, I tell all my patients, if you want to come down, reduce your dose, go in a slow taper, I'll support you in every way possible.
Mm-hmm.
I will in every way help you. And if you fail, I'd like to say, I can't always say this, I'll bring you right back into the clinic again if and when you fail.
Right,
okay?
Right.
Because that's the nature of the disease, failing.
Right.
Relapses is part of the diagnosis.
Right.
Part of the disease. That last part we don't do a good job on in our treatment. But you know, I tell patients, you may be on this for a very, very long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily. With a slow taper, you might accomplish
okay.
What we both want.
Sure.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to make a point of is about sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to I've had many clients who, you know, they've been attending meetings and they'll come back to check in with me and I'll say, do you have a sponsor yet? No, I don't have a sponsor. You don't have a sponsor? You don't have, I think I'm doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, no, that's not the way the program works. You know, you go to a meeting and introduce yourself and you say that you need a temporary sponsor. Because what that person becomes for you is like a lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
When you get the urge to use, you call them.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people, the urge to use never lasts longer than the time it takes to dial a phone number. Once you get that sponsor on the phone, sometimes just leaving a message, just saying you get their answering system and then you talk into it and describe what you're going through, can often lower that threshold of impulsivity, of compulsion to go find the drug enough to wait for the sponsor to call you back when they're on a break, or, you know, they wake up or what have you. But that network of folks. The other thing you reminded me of, John, is that there's no chronic illness that I know of where there's one treatment.
That's right.
You know, if you have diabetes, you know, there may be, you know, dietary adjustments in addition to medication, in addition to exercise, and you pull any one of those three out, you're setting the client up for the patient up for failure.
But if it's serious diabetes,
yes,
and insulin isn't part of it,
yes,
you're probably going to fail.
Then you're going to fail.
Okay? Exactly. But insulin by itself, you're going to fail too.
Exactly.
So you're right. Those other treatments are necessary, but not sufficient.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because you and I both have had chronic diabetic patients who've been on insulin for years, but they're not in any support group. Mm-hmm. They go out and they're smoking. They're binging. They're sneaking out on their wife and going to the 7-Eleven and eating a box of donuts. Why? Because they don't have a support. They don't have anybody they can call to say, you know, I'm really having a craving for a lot of sugar right now. And the person on the other, I know what you mean. You want to get together. You want to go for a walk. Yeah, that support network. In addition, the insulin is a setup for failure. It's just like many forms of cancer, where it requires surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And it's just like many of these folks in the addiction treatment field are saying, well, maybe you don't need the surgery, or maybe you don't need the radiation. When the studies have shown that for that particular form of surgery, all three, you know, lend the greatest percentage of success, mm-hmm. why would you handicap that person by only offering, you know, two of the three? Or, mm-hmm.
So, as I say, in her article, she really leaves it up to us.
Margaret Talbot.
Margaret Talbot's article. She mm-hmm. leaves it up to us. Us meaning the entire community. I would also advise that you listen to competent medical authority, CDC, FDA, DEA, whoever you want to listen to, and you use evidence-based treatments. We all agree that each patient needs a different form of treatment, mm-hmm. okay? And taken together, as we've said here several times in this conversation, they are fairly effective, okay? People will fail, okay? Bring them back again and try again. That's the nature of a lot of diseases, particularly psychological diseases, okay? Psychiatric mm-hmm. conditions. Mm-hmm. Failing is part of the disease, okay?
Absolutely.
But to get them into long-term recovery, doing all of these things, the 12-step, the close contact with other people, some people actually say that the key component of addiction is separation. You are not attached to anybody. It's detachment mm-hmm. from everybody around. Mm-hmm. So fix that partly with a 12-step program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
and but again, it's evidence-based. The importance of psychosocial counseling. That's why it's called medication-assisted treatment. There's a hyphen between medication and assisted. Okay, mm-hmm. very important hyphen. The medication is not the treatment.
Right.
Okay. The treatment is all that other stuff Zachy and I have been talking about.
So is there any way that the county government could implement some part of this program on its own?
Well, one approach would be for the county government and everybody else to start talking about evidence-based treatment programs.
Well, I'm assuming that, you know, the county health department is led by an evidence-based... I'm asking how to fix it, not... You know,
what about the day center in Ranson? I heard a rumor they're doing needle exchanges and they're doing Vivitrol, or they were considering doing Vivitrol.
Well, wait. Yeah, I don't know if they're doing needle exchange. We do have needle exchange programs in both counties now.
Berkeley and Jefferson County.
But health departments, not the DRCs
okay.
that I know of. I don't think it's the DRCs.
Okay.
Don't forget... People in therapy don't need needles, sort of by definition of being in therapy,
mm-hmm.
okay? So a needle exchange program in a clinic treating heroin addicts would be kind of oxymoronic, right? I mean, what would be the point of that? But the two counties do, and those are for people who aren't in therapy. Okay, mm-hmm. That's the 90% of people who are addicted who aren't in therapy. Those people need help. We often talk about the therapy and the people who are in therapy. We don't talk maybe often enough of the other 90% mm-hmm. who need clean needles, who need someone to check them for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV, and these other bloodborne diseases. We need somebody to act like we care. Mm-hmm. And that's what the health, it's called harm reduction programs. That's what the harm reduction programs do. Okay. And they're just in an infancy stage right now, but this is good.
Okay.
This, we at least are getting there. People ask how we got to this state here. And I say there's no adequate access to medication-assisted treatment, no harm reduction programs, no needle exchange programs, way inadequate counseling services, mm-hmm. Proper trained counseling, very poor payer systems. Medicaid is better than nothing, but it's got a lot. It could do a lot better. One of the reasons we got this way is because we weren't doing anything right. Okay, we were leaving too many things off the table that are evidence-based and effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way to do it right is to simply accept the fact that some of these things are very important. The needle exchange. I've had people say the needle exchange program is terrible because it's just enabling addicts.
Right.
But if you talk to these patients, when you tell a guy he's got hepatitis C, a 30, 35-year-old guy, and he starts crying, it's pretty emotional.
Well, I mean, I think let's go back to your evidence-based argument, because I mean, when someone says to you, "Oh, I needle exchange just aids the addicts," what's the evidence, buddy, for that?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, what is the evidence for that? And of course, they don't have any. It's just an opinion.
People have done studies on that. It does not increase opiate use.
I'm sure it doesn't. But here's the question. See, let's say you're a surrogate, because you and I are retired. I know you don't want another big job, but your surrogate is now the public health officer for the county, and your county commission is in love with him because he's evidence based. Okay, and that would involve firing two or three members of the current county commission, but that's okay. We'll get to that. The question is that now you're there. Okay, so now the county has a limited fundraising ability. It has the property tax fundamentally, okay, and it can float a bond if all four out of five commissioners agree five times in a row or some crap like that, okay?
Wow.
That's its fundraising capacity, okay, right there. And it's the only entity in the county that has really any fundraising capacity at all is the county, all right? I mean, the towns can raise 1%, I think. That's it.
The county can write grant requests.
Okay, it can do that as well.
See,
okay.
I can't. I don't know how to write a grant request.
Maybe that would be the answer. The point is that whatever the means, I think the idea that a evidence-based policy could have an impact, or the proposal that if we do ABC, medically assisted treatment, okay, and if we start with a certain population, can we prove that this will work, and can we also demonstrate how much it's going to cost, okay, to do so? And, I think if that kind of an argument, I don't see ultimately where, if you get the discussion started with the right group of people, there have to be plenty of people. I mean, look at Jan Hafer, who ran for county commissioner. Her own daughter, family. She has that issue in her own family. Okay, and I don't think that defeated her campaign. Yeah. I mean, there were other factors that got involved there, and she was pretty close, actually. She would have been a good candidate, but I just see how can we make reasonable promises or at least commitments, offerings to the public in the county, and then try to get something concrete done in an area where we might have enough influence to try to influence the outcome, mm-hmm. okay? We're not going to have any impact on the state of West Virginia from this area, but it's not going to happen.
No.
I mean, if you think you're crazy, if you think so, they'll be lucky if they don't shut down completely on July 1st. They'll be lucky. if they get a deal. Right? I hear the Republicans walked out of the meeting with the governor yesterday, day before yesterday. God. Yeah. I mean, because the Republican Senate will not give up on the tax cut in the midst of a deficit of $400 or $500 million. Because they're, you know, these guys are, I mean, that's the only interest they have. They don't want to pay any taxes, and they don't care if the public services go away and you fall on your ass and die by the side of the road. They won't even do what the Cherokee did, which is give the old people a blanket to sit on the side of the hill as they had to move out to Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not even going to do that. So it's my friends in the early days used to call this a class struggle, pal, and that's what it is.
What also has to happen is finding something that is doing some good and saying, as we're doing right now, that is doing some good. Let's continue that. For example, Zaki, you mentioned the day report centers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And some of them now are, some of them do give Vivitrol. It's one of these deals. You take the Vivitrol or you go back to prison. That's quite a motivation to continue taking the Vivitrol. But they're also getting counseling. They're also getting good counseling in the meantime.
Explain to our listeners what Vivitrol does.
Vivitrol is called a narcotic antagonist. It blocks the pleasure receptors in the brain. So when heroin tries to make you feel good, it can't get to that receptor.
Right.
So it's blocked completely.
And it's an injection that the client will agree to take that lasts for a month.
It's a deep IM injection. It is not a simple, it's not like a shot from a measles vaccine or something, you know. It's a deep injection.
Oh, don't make it sound so ominous. I used to give them all the time.
They use a medieval sword and they drive it right through your back end.
If you have a good phlebotomist, you can barely feel it, you know.
Okay.
You got to know what you're doing.
All right. But it's certainly
not a drug that causes a lot of pain once it's injected.
But the problem with Vivitrol, I have found, mm-hmm. and if you look at the literature, which is very scant so far. This only came out, I think, 2007 or something, approved by the FDA for opiate use quite recently. Okay. If you look at the data, there isn't good data for how many people stay on the shot on their own.
Mm.
The data is miserable, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
They've done a couple studies where they give the shot to people as they leave prison or jail.
Okay.
How many come back for the second shot? Less than 50%.
Well,
how many come back for the third? It keeps dropping and dropping.
Do they have to go back to the jail to get the shot?
No, no, no. Okay. They line them up with the clinic. I'm not sure who the payer is in that system for the shot. It's probably the county, but they line them up with a payer. They can get. They decide they don't want Vivitrol anymore. That's the bottom line.
And
as opposed to the agonists and the partial agonists, buprenorphine and methadone, they keep coming back. That's a fact. That's the data. Now, that's limited data. It's not very complete yet because no one's studying it very well. But that was my own experience when I was giving Vivitrol shots. It's also the experience, the people who have looked at it have come to that same conclusion. Patients don't want to stay on it. Now, if you're talking about you go to prison or you get your shot,
right?
You
exactly.
You don't have a problem. Okay. So, but if retention and compliance
mm-hmm.
are the biggest problems you've got, Vivitrol probably isn't the way to go.
Okay. That's all right. I'm not convinced because, you know, I'm thinking about when, you know, I would have chronic mentally ill people mm-hmm. who had, you know, had to go to the state mental health hospital multiple times. Mm-hmm. And so, it got to the point where a mental health judge, a commissioner said, well, you know, I'm court ordering you into treatment. Mm-hmm. And because this patient had a terrible compliance record, you know, they would always stop taking their oral medicines. They were required to come to the clinic monthly for an injection. And, most people don't like to get shots. Mm-hmm. But some of these, you know, clients realize that, you know, it's the shot or it's I'm going to end up back in the state hospital.
That's compliant.
And I'm court ordered. So I just go do it. And it becomes a part of my life. And it's no big deal.
No, I agree.
I'm just wondering.
I'm talking about a person who isn't court ordered.
Right. Well, yeah.
Okay. Most people, I hope, still. Okay. Most people in this world. Okay.
Okay.
to make that your first line treatment. I've had people come and asking for Vivitrol, and they weren't court ordered. They want the shot. And it's sometimes 5 or 6 months. They come in a week or two later. They're transformed. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how well they do. It's I don't know why it works so well on the cravings and stuff. I don't understand that pharmacologically.
Well, you know, the other aspect of this disease, John, is it convinces us that we're in control. Mm-hmm. You know, that I can do it on my own now. Yeah. I mean, you know, the overconfidence phenomenon that sets in after you've had a few weeks or months of sobriety, abstinence, then I can do this on my own. I don't need that shot. You know, I don't need to go to this, see that counselor. And those people ultimately relapse.
One of the, it's hard to find humor in this profession, okay? But there are some things that are humorous.
Please.
And that's the reaction of a patient when you suggest getting a shot instead of Suboxone or Methadone. Oh, I'm scared of needles. They're addicted to heroin.
Right.
I'm scared of needles. The other interesting phenomenon is that
I'm scared of other people's needles, not my own needles.
No, I'm scared of those too. These people are terrified of hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. They're terrified of the bloodborne pathogens, terrified of them, but they don't have any choice.
Right.
This is not a choice disease. But
meaning they'll take the risk of catching hepatitis or HIV if they need a fix.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But that's how powerful.
But then there's another phenomenon that they've actually done a study. Okay, you have a 22 gauge needle you use to draw blood from a person's arm. Mm-hmm. Same person drawing all the blood. Okay, same needle, same situation. Who hurts worse? Who's yelling the loudest? It's actually the people who are addicted.
Really?
Yeah, they have less tolerance of pain. This is a very specific pain. Mm-hmm. It's the same on 100 people. They're getting the same needle in the same place in their arm. Mm-hmm. Some people yell louder than others. Mm-hmm. And it's the patients in addiction. They have a different sense of pain. And some people say that is one of the founding causal factors in addiction. How do all these people start? They start using pain pills. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's not a coincidence. That's probably real. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. Maybe these are fairly minor pains, but if they keep using this stuff, they have more pain to treat. Because as they become more addicted, they have, it's called hyperalgesia. They have more pain. So, it is interesting watching patients.
Any research into that?
Yes, yeah. Hyperalgesia is in patients in addiction is very real. There are some back surgeons who won't operate on a patient while they're still on narcotics, while they're still using heroin, because they know they won't get good results. This is what the orthopedic surgeons say. Mm-hmm. They won't get good results with the surgery as long as the person is confronted with hyperalgesia.
But I'm talking about if people who are prone to addiction actually have a different form of processing of pain.
No, it's after they're already addicted.
After they're already addicted.
No, it isn't before then, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, okay, so maybe that's just association with needles, right? You know, then now this is
Could
a bigger one, you
Could
know,
be.
And so then blah, blah, you know, something like that.
They often say every time that someone approaches them with a needle, they start shaking because they're so... They're afraid they're going to relapse. Mm-hmm. That this is a huge trigger, a needle coming at them, a huge trigger. So, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
That could be, yeah.
Well, I hope that you have someone in line to both take over the county commission and also get rid of the, and get a evidence-based, you know, program at the county health. And then you go, and then see what we can accomplish. I just keep coming back to that because I don't think there's, you can, it's like my friend John Christensen, right? You know, who has been, was the Mountain View Solar, was helping subsidize his trips. They probably should have paid him more than they did. But anyway, they subsidized his trips down to Charleston to lobby for the solar power, over and over and over again every year. And he also, you know, did some work for the AFL-CIO when he was down there. And so he was kind of our, that. But finally, you know, the Mountain View Solar, my understanding is, and some of the other other people that were contributing said, well, what's the point of even talking to these guys down there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, why waste your time and money? Because you'll talk to them and they just ignore you. And so they gave it up, you know. I mean, I don't think they're paying for it anymore. At least not now. No, they just said this.
You should hear the problems that Peter Callahan is getting trying to set up his detox center.
In Martinsburg.
Unbelievable, the trouble he's getting from the state.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Probably from the Attorney General, among others. Yeah.
It's really tragic because we really absolutely need that here. No. And everyone in this field agrees we need it here. If you send somebody 2 hours away to Clarksburg or these other places, they're gone. They're out of your sphere of influence.
Right.
If they're right here in town,
right,
a family member, a relative, a friend, a significant other, his doctor can actually go when they're in the detox center, calm things down, and keep them there. Otherwise, they just walk out.
Sure. Sure.
If they're 2 hours away, they just walk out of the place.
Yeah.
So we need that here desperately. And Charleston just doesn't care.
We've been talking with Dr. John Aldis, MD, about the article in The New Yorker in which he was featured called The Addicts Next Door by Margaret Talbot.
We ought to let him go get his car because he's about to get ticketed soldiers that run this town here. So anyway.
Any final thoughts, impressions, John, from the article?
I was totally impressed by her writing skill. She did it beautifully. She stayed off subjects she knew would be pointless, like recommending solutions to this. She left that up to the reader. But she saw this problem from so many depths, from so many levels, and brought them all out on the surface in one article. Most articles, they talk about one problem or another. She brought it from all the perspectives at the same time. It's the same problem, just looked at many, many different ways. So in having 25 articles describing it, she has one article. This is what we got. What are we going to do about it?
Okay. Well, thanks so much, John.
Thank you so much, John. All right. Well, we could keep working together on it and see if we can find a path to light, as the Quakers say. All right. Yeah. All right. We'll be right back in just a second. Take a little break here. And with the conclusion of the Are You Crazy show, thank you, Dr. Aldis, for helping us out here.
Good to be here.
All right. Take care.